Good evening, everybody. Let's start off with our motivation. Last week, we were talking about the eight worldly concerns and how they grabbed us and grabbed our attention and took us away from the Dharma path. So it's good to repeatedly contemplate this so that we don't let the attachment to the happiness of only this life take us away and run us around in circles. That's so that we remember the Buddhist worldview and the importance of preparing for future lives, the importance of liberation and full awakening. And so for that reason, the need to overcome the attachment to only this life that restricts our mind, restricts our priorities, restricts our actions. And instead to really cultivate a big mind that goes beyond our own petty concerns for immediate pleasure and looks at the long-term spiritual aims and includes the happiness and well-being of all living beings. So with that kind of awareness, let's generate the bodhicitta. You, in this last week, thought a little bit about how the eight worldly concerns narrows your perspective. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how when our mind is completely grabbing on to the happiness of this life, we can't see beyond what our own immediate wants are. And when we can't see beyond, you know, what the attachment to the immediate pleasures are, then we certainly aren't interested in creating the cause for anything beyond our own immediate pleasure. Yeah? So we forget about future lives. That somebody else is reborn, you know, why should I care about them? We forget about liberation. Like, what do you mean liberation? It sounds nihilistic, you know, kind of. Huh? Or, you know, we forget about full enlightenment. Oh, that's too impractical. And so our mind just gets completely, you know, that image of the donkey with its ring through its nose, and we get pulled by that attachment to the happiness of only this life, that only cares, you know, our immediate pleasure. And so, you know, that being the four of the eight worldly concerns, to obtain four of them and to be free of other four. So to obtain, you know, sensual pleasure, good taste, yeah, good smell, good sights, good sounds, you know, nice music, comfortable bed, good sex life, you know, and then to be free of any kind of physical sensorial discomfort. To have people praise and approve of us, we really want that, don't we? Yeah. We don't like to get blamed, and we don't like disapproval. That's really a hook. Okay. But the sense pleasure is really a hook too, isn't it? Because when we're uncomfortable, you know, I mean, we get so irritated, so angry. When we want something, you know, for our own comfort, we're very demanding. Then we also like fame. We want a good reputation. Yeah, a little fame wouldn't hurt. Lots of people talking about me behind my back saying wonderful things. Everybody knows my name. My name, my reputation precedes me. I walk in a room and they all stop. There she is. you know? And so that goes with having power. You know, lots of times we want, because of reputation, so we want power, we want to win, we want to be the best, we want people to listen to us, do what we say. Yeah. Not as we do, but do as we say. Okay. And then, of course, we want material wealth too, don't we? Yeah, whatever kind of objects or possessions or stash of cash we think we need, we want it. And, you know, we're very unhappy if we lose the material things we like. If somebody breaks something that belongs to us, yeah, we're unhappy, we're dejected, we get angry. Yeah. If somebody steals it, somebody misuses our property, somebody forgets our birthday and doesn't give us a birthday present, oh, we're so offended. Yeah? So we're quite attached to material things too. And then, you know, have a lot of aversion when we don't have those. And we'll riot and we'll protest when we don't have. You know, we'll go to the streets when we don't have the material things we want. Yeah. So you see that, this, the mind that's very attached to just this life, that can't think beyond this life, that really dominates things, and it drags us along behind it, you know, leading us to create all sorts of negative actions. And to, it keeps us very busy, so we have no time for Dharma practice. No time to think of others because we're too busy thinking about our own gains. No time to think of liberation because we're too busy thinking of how to get what we want now. Okay, and so that makes us ignore ethical conduct. Yeah, because to keep good ethical conduct, we have to give up that mind that's saying my happiness now. I want what I want when I want it. Yeah, we have to give that up in order to really create, you know, have good ethical conduct. So this isn't a question of, you know, we're bad because we have the eight worldly concerns, or we're bad because we're attached to the happiness of this life. It's not, you know, something we should go and judge ourselves on. That just makes the whole thing worse, because that's all involved with approval and disapproval and praise and blame. So it's not that question. It's a question of, we want to be happy, we want other people to be happy. What gets in the way of our being happy, and what helps us to be happy? And by happy, I don't mean giddy happy, like, oh, you know, this is me. I mean a peaceful, kind of stable, balanced joy. You know? So what contributes to that, and what interferes with it? And when we really look closely, that attachment to the happiness of this life interferes with our joy. Yeah? Because if we look so often, you know, okay, when we want to be peaceful and joyful. Yeah. When we get into arguments and quarrels with other people, are we peaceful and joyful? Mm-hmm. Forget it. Okay? What makes us get into arguments and quarrels with other people? What are most of our arguments and quarrels about? Yeah, things that have to do with the self-centered attitude. And in particular, what do you argue with people about?
Our own way, sense of pleasure, gain, fame, blame.
Yeah, we argue about, you know, I want to be powerful, I want you to approve of me, I want you to respect me, I want you to give me a good reputation. I don't want you to, you know, get in my way and blame me for things, especially things I didn't do. Yeah, I don't want you to take my stuff. I want you to give me your stuff. Yeah. And if you cause me to have any kind of discomfort, I'm going to be really upset. Yeah, if you sit on my cushion in the meditation hall, if you, you know, kind of break my mala, if you, you know, kind of don't look at me properly, all these kinds of things. Well, I'm just going to get upset and go on the warpath. You know, so when we look, what are the things we quarrel most with people about? It usually has something to do with the eight worldly concerns. Yeah, so there's our proof right away that the more we have this kind of attachment to four members and dejection, you know, when we have the other four, then the more we're setting ourselves up for having tumultuous relationships. Yeah. So it's very interesting, you know, when you read the news, yeah, just read the news with this awareness of the eight worldly concerns and with an awareness of karma. And look at the actions that people do and ask yourself what is motivating them to do those actions. And see, you know, then you can really see for yourself the relationship between the eight worldly concerns and, you know, the negative karma that the people are doing. Or if you happen to read an article, one of those rare articles where they talk about all the goodness in the world, even though there is so much, they don't put it in the newspaper. You know, when you read an article like that, then ask yourself, okay, what kind of thought, what kind of action is behind that? And is that thought, you know, that motivating act, the motivation of those actions, does that have anything to do with the eight worldly concerns? Or is it going beyond, you know, the happiness of me, myself, I, yeah, and all that? Okay. So it's a very interesting way to read the news. Mm-hmm. And when you listen to your friends talk to you, yeah, you call up your friend and they're complaining, oh, my husband did na 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 na, and my child did da 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 da, and my pet pig did da da da, and, you know, this one did that and that one, you know, and you just listen to what people are unhappy about and see how that relates to attachment to the happiness of this life. See how, you know, the misery they experience relates to their own worldview, and when they never had the big picture, and they're only looking at the small one of my happiness now, how that thought actually makes them more unhappy, and it makes them create the cause of more unhappiness. And then, of course, since it's so easy to see that in others, then the big trick is to turn the mirror, turn the eyeglass, and look this way. And how does that affect my life? Mm-hmm. And then come home to the fact of, but I want to be happy. So let's create the causes for happiness. Yeah. That's going to mean transforming my mind, letting go of clinging on to the things that in the long run make me miserable. Hmm? Yeah, I was just reading a book because one of our supporters met somebody who wrote a book about her sister who's on death row, and had written, you know, a book about it. So she gave it to me to read because she knows I'm interested in the whole capital punishment thing. So the sister who's now on death row was a meth addict. You know, now, if you know anything about meth, it's just, I mean, it completely destroys your life. Totally destroys your life. Destroys your brain, destroys your relationships, destroys your discriminating awareness, destroys your health, you know. But you can see that when people have that addiction to meth, that's one of the eight worldly concerns, isn't it? You know, it's to good sensual stimuli. So to get the drug, then you need money. So then you get into attachment to getting the money to buy the drug. Okay, then what do to get the money to buy the drug? Yeah, you do anything. Anything you can possibly do. Yeah? because the mind so has so much attachment to the drug, yeah, completely controls the mind, controls the life. Yeah. So then you do just anything to get the drug, and that takes you into all sorts of negative actions. Yeah, and then even you get the money, even you get the drug, then what do you do under the influence of the drug? I mean, you can't think clearly. You can't make wise decisions. You completely, you know, the brain is just frazzled. Okay? So again, creating so much cause for more suffering. And yet the thing that's in there is this incredible attachment to the happiness of this life. And what's under that is incredible pain and not knowing how to deal with the pain, and so masking it by getting, you know, the big rush of the happiness of this life. So it's a very sad situation. It's an incredibly sad situation. But if you look at that, you know, and you just, this is, you know, you read this book and, you know, this is a Dharma teaching. This is Dharma teaching. So, yeah, so anything you read, you know, can become a Dharma teaching for you in that way. Okay. Any questions about that or comments about it? So it's rather shocking to think about that a lot. Yeah. But like I told you, Lama Sopa would give an entire 1 month meditation course on the evil thought of the eight worldly concerns. And he hammered it into us, you know, this group of 60s hippies, you know, talk about attachment to the happiness of this life. We embodied it. And he would give a whole month on that. No. Of course, all the people who weren't hippies embodied it too. It's just they were attached to things that were more socially acceptable. Yeah, but you know, attachment is attachment in terms of how you create karma. It doesn't really matter. Yeah. So you'd get entire courses about it. But I'm so glad he did. So glad, because it really got, you know, imprinted in the mind. And I see that nowadays many people, they've never heard a teaching about it. Yeah? And I think they really miss something. Really miss something. You know, because Rinpoche so pinpointed out to us, you know, because we always want to know, what's a Dharma action? What's not a Dharma action? Yeah? I want to practice Dharma. What's a Dharma action? I want to do virtue. What's a virtuous action? Then he said, that dividing line, yeah, is whether there's the attachment to only the happiness of this life or not. That differentiated a Dharma action from a worldly action. Yeah. So you can see that even though we call ourselves Dharma practitioners, in many ways it's very hard to be a real Dharma practitioner. It's really a challenge, you know. So we practice at our own level, and that's why we take precepts, because precepts really help us stop the attachment to the eight worldly concerns. Yeah. But we can't just rest on saying, well, I'm a Dharma practitioner, I'm okay. We have to really see, is our mind practicing the Dharma, or is our mind, you know, obsessed by the happiness of this life?
I think once I learned a little bit about the Dharma, the eight worldly concerns even got more hidden, because on the surface it looked like I was practicing, but the propelling motivation behind it was totally still the eight worldly concerns.
Yeah.
But I really thought that I was, you know, my mind was in a good place, but it wasn't.
Yeah. Well, we progress in stages. You know, And like you said, at first you thought you were really practicing. Later you discovered there was a lot of eight worldly concerns mixed in it. Well, I'm sure how you were practicing at the beginning was much better than you were before you even started.
Yeah, I was thinking a little bit before I did stuff.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You thought a little bit before you did stuff, which wasn't the case before. Before you just did it.
Well, I did.
And never looked back.
I did, but I wanted to do it because I wanted to get something. I wanted people to like me. I mean, I was doing it for the eight worldly concerns, not realizing that was a non-virtuous thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But see, I mean, Dharma practice and really looking at our motivations, it's something that it comes in waves, you know. We're not going to get the perfect motivation all at once. Because I too remember, you know, having practiced for some years and then in the middle of one retreat, it just hit me. It's like everything I do is the eight worldly concerns. Yeah, but I think that was really good that I saw that, because then I could start doing something about it, you know. But still, I mean, it's important to give ourselves credit for what we do, instead of just saying, oh, it's not perfect, so I don't do anything. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, if we hold this incredibly high perfectionist standard, then we're all always going to be shooting on ourselves. Yeah, which doesn't really help much. So let's not try and be perfectionists. Let's just keep peeling away the distracting motivations.
What I notice is that, you know, we're always setting our motivation at the abhi, but it's not in every moment. So I notice that the motivation gets set, and then it's sort of like running out of gas really quick.
Right.
And it's just back to the same old
thing. Yeah. And so that's why frequently during the day we renew our motivation. That's why at the beginning of every session we take refuge and generate bodhicitta. That's why we do chanting, you know, before our meals. That's why, you know, our whole day is spent remembering the Dharma during different intervals of the day, because, you know, we remember it and set a good motivation, and then we come up again. But, you know, still, it's quite good that we're doing that throughout the day. Imagine what our lives would be like if we didn't do that. Really a mess, huh? Really a mess. So at least now, you know, you might get irritated and then you go, oh, I got mad. You know, whereas before you'd go, I got irritated. I should have screamed louder at that person. You know, I let them run all over me. I have to go in tomorrow and really show them who's boss. Okay. Yeah.
I was thinking about a lot of the people that I looked up to before I found the Dharma. I don't know, like Condi, or like, I'm thinking of David Attenborough, like people who specifically didn't believe in reincarnation, but they had a kind of motivation to kind of better the world. And I wonder how that relates to the eight worldly concerns. Like, they're not necessarily thinking of the happiness of this life, but this person. They're trying to contribute something, but they're not. You know, they don't have the Dharma.
Okay, so what about people who are incredibly kind people who do so much to improve the world, but they don't necessarily believe in the Dharma or believe in rebirth and liberation and so on? Gandhi, by the way, was a Hindu, so he did accept rebirth.
Right, yeah, I know, that's why Gandhi wasn't the best.
Yeah, but you know, there's other people. Yes, they create a lot of good karma because they're acting with an unselfish and kind motivation. Yeah, so they do create good karma. You don't have to be a Buddhist practitioner to create good karma. Okay, so they create good karma. But, you know, if you have studied more about exactly how to create good karma, then you know really how to guide your mind in a really good way. You know, but a lot of these people, you know, just through the goodness of their own heart and their genuine compassion and altruism, you know, really give up their own happiness of this life for the benefit of other living beings. And that's so incredible, isn't it? Yeah. So whether they're Buddhist or not, whether they believe in rebirth or not, they seem to have much more compassion than we do. Yeah. So we shouldn't go around like, I'm a Buddhist.
I remember a teaching by Jetsun Ma Tenzin Palmo, and she framed the eight worldly concerns as living in constant hope and fear.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite useful. Like, if I saw my mind like really hoping for something, or that there was a lot of fear, most probably behind that there would be attachment to something or aversion to it.
Yeah. So you're saying that the Jetsuma really emphasized that behind the eight worldly concerns, there's hope and there's fear. Because you're hoping for four and you're fearing the other four. Yeah? So, but we have to be careful here, because that kind of hope we want to give up. But then some people just take it too far and say, does that mean you just give up all hope for the world whatsoever? Well, no, it doesn't mean that. I mean, it's always, His Holiness is always talking about the importance of hope, the importance of optimism. So it's a particular kind of hope that we're talking about giving up in relationship to the eight worldly concerns. We're not talking about giving up all hope whatsoever. Okay? We're giving up the hope of our own personal pleasure arriving immediately. Okay. Yeah. But hope in terms of for oppressed people to be free, for, you know, unloved people to be loved, for, you know, things like that. Yes, we must hold on to hope for, in those ways. Okay. And similarly with fear, there's a certain kind of fear we want to give up. You know, the fear of, you know, oh, people won't like me, I'm going to have a bad reputation, I'm going to get blamed, I won't have what I want, I'm going to be miserable. That kind of fear we want to give up. Okay. But a sense of caution about creating non-virtue, or a sense of caution about being born in an unfortunate realm, or a fear of, you know, being born where there's no dharma. That kind of fear is a completely different kind of fear. It's not a frenzied panic fear. It's a kind of fear that has a component of wisdom. We don't want to give that up. Okay? So in these kinds of things, it's very important to understand, what do we mean by hope? What do we mean by fear? Because, you know, as with anything, when you study the Dharma, if you don't understand it properly, you misinterpret it, and then you get stuck. So that's why it's always important to ask questions to make sure that we're understanding something correctly. Okay, shall we go into our little thing of objects? Mm-hmm. Yeah? So, I know many of you started reading books, afterwards. There's Geshe Rabdon's book, there's Betsy Knepper's, Lati Rinpoche's book, there's different things. And I really, you know, was cautioning you to beware of the translation of the terms. I was reading I just skimmed a little bit of the thought file you sent, and there was one thing where they said, where the appearing object or apprehended object, da 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 da, in other words, making it sound like appearing object and apprehending object were the same thing. Mm-hmm. Well, that's because that's the way they translated. They translated what I call beheld object as apprehended object, whereas what I translate as apprehended object is something completely different than the appearing object. So it's very, very important in all these, you know, I think just get one set of terminology, and if you can, be aware of what the Tibetan is, and then keep anything you read translated into that one set of terminology. Okay? So, Just to review here, okay? We were talking about the appearing object, which most translators seem to have the same thing. That's the nangyo, and that's the actual object held by the mind. Mm-hmm. And it's synonymous with the beheld object, which is the zungyo. Okay. Then we have the engaged object, which is the main object or the principal object of that cognizer. And that's synonymous with the apprehended object, or as Jeffrey translates it, the object of the mode of apprehension, which is the object that is understood by that cognition. In other words, what that cognizer is actually apprehending. Then you have the conceived objects. That's only for conceptual consciousnesses, and that is the engaged or apprehended object of a conceptual consciousness. And then you have the focal object, or the migyal, which is sometimes observed object, and that's the object that is observed. Okay? So in the Sao Tantrika system, which we were studying here, okay, permanent objects are apprehended only by conceptual minds. And impermanent things are apprehended only by non-conceptual minds. Okay? So when we start looking at these different kinds of objects, you know, if we have the mind that's looking at the green of the tablecloth, the appearing object is, this is a visual consciousness apprehending the green, the appearing object is green. The engaged object?
Green.
The conceived object?
Doesn't have one.
The focal object?
Green.
Green. Okay. Now, if you're thinking about the green of the grass from when you were a kid, okay, is that a conceptual or a non-conceptual mind?
Conceptual.
Conceptual. What's the appearing object?
The conceptual image of green.
Yeah, the conceptual appearance of green. Okay, what's the engaged object?
Green.
What's the conceived object?
The conceptual appearance.
The conceptual appearance of green. What's the apprehended object? Still green.
Yeah.
Still green.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it direct?
No, it's a conceptual. Right. Right. Okay. Okay. So when we we can kind of understand, you know. Okay, what about like an inference perceiving the sound to be impermanent? What's the appearing object? A conceptual mind, an inference that's apprehending sound is impermanent. Okay, get that, get your mind, make your mind into an inference that's conceptual mind that's apprehending sound as impermanent. What's the appearing object to your mind?
The appearance of permanence.
The conceptual appearance of sound. What's the apprehended object? Or the conceptual appearance of impermanent sound. Okay. What's the apprehended object?
Nothing.
What are you apprehending?
The conceptual sound.
Okay. Go back, go in your mind, okay, and say sound is impermanent because it's a product of causes. Uh-huh. Okay? So do you understand sound is impermanent because because it's a product of causes and the causes are changing all the time?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what's the appearing object to your mind when you're cognizing that? What is appearing to that conceptual mind that apprehends sound as impermanent? We just did
conceptual.
It 2 seconds ago.
Conceptual. image of the sound.
The conceptual appearance of
impermanent
sound. That's what's appearing to that conceptual mind. What is the main thing that that mind is apprehending?
The impermanence of the sound.
Yeah, impermanent sound.
A conception of impermanent sound.
No, it's not apprehending a conception of an impermanent sound. Your mind just made the inference. Sound is impermanent because it's a product of causes.
Right.
Is the main thing you're understanding a conception of impermanent sound, or is the main thing you're understanding impermanent sound?
It is, sound. But I thought we just said that a conception could only have a permanent object.
That's the appearing object.
As the appearing object. I see.
Yeah.
So it can refer to an impermanent. Of course it can. It has to.
Yeah. That's how else are you going to perceive impermanent sound?
How are you going to perceive anything?
Yeah. I mean, if you don't have a direct realization of impermanent sound, okay, but you know sound is impermanent, how are you going to perceive that?
Through conception.
So what's the main thing you're apprehending?
Impermanent sound.
Okay. Now, let's say you're one of these guys, you know, who from the Vedas, who thinks sound is impermanent.
Permanent.
Who thinks sound is permanent. So they're going around saying sound is permanent. Is that conceptual or non-conceptual?
Conceptual.
What's the appearing object?
The conceptual appearance of permanent sound.
The conceptual appearance of permanent sound. What is the apprehended object?
Permanent sound.
Is that an actual apprehended object?
No.
No, why not?
Because it doesn't exist.
Okay. So therefore we say that cognition is erroneous or wrong. Okay, because we make something becomes a wrong consciousness with respect to its apprehended object. Okay, so the permanent sound doesn't exist. That consciousness that is apprehending permanent sound is wrong with respect to that, you know, permanent sound, because, so, you know, it's a wrong consciousness. Okay. Yeah.
Is conceptual image the same as meaning generally?
Yes.
I just sometimes get thoughts from.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I'm trying to stay with one vocabulary, conceptual appearance, rather than mental image, meaning generality, all the different ways that people can translate it. Generic image.
So what is your current
conceptual? I just said it. Conceptual appearance.
But even when you're saying conceptual image, we've been talking, so I've been...
I have?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, I thought I was you guys were saying conceptual image, and I kept on saying no conceptual appearance.
That's what I'm hearing, let's put it that way.
Okay. So, conceptual appearance.
Okay.
Yeah. So is a conceptual appearance the actual object?
No.
Okay. Why not? What's the difference between thinking about green and looking at green?
One's through the
image. It's past moments of that object.
Okay, one is the eye consciousness, one's the mental consciousness. But what's the difference in the way you're apprehending it?
One is really vivid.
One's vivid and one is not as vivid. It's much fuzzier. Okay. And one is this particular green here at this particular moment. The other one is a composite of different kind of green or different moments of even this green that you've put together. Okay. Now, where it gets tricky is when we start with some other things. Okay. Well, let's just do, okay. How about The okay, let's say, well, you know, you have a mind that grasps the person as a self-sufficient, substantially existent. Is that conceptual or non-conceptual?
Conceptual.
Conceptual. What's the appearing object?
Self-sufficient,
the conceptual appearance of the self-sufficient of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Okay. What's the apprehended object? Self-sufficient, substantially existent person. What's the conceived object? Self-sufficient, substantially existent person. What's the focal object? The person. Is that mind a wrong consciousness or correct consciousness?
Wrong.
Why? There's no such thing as a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. So it is erroneous with respect to its
object.
To
the observed object.
The engaged object or the apprehended object. Remember I said if it's a wrong consciousness, it's wrong or erroneous with respect to its engaged or apprehended object. The focal object is just the main thing, you know, that you're talking about. So in this case, it's the person. In the one about permanent sound or impermanent sound, it's just sound. Yeah.
Does it differ if it's a conceptual or a non-conceptual?
Well, it depends what the situation is. Yeah. But it's just the general object about which you may be talking about some of its attributes. Okay. So it's interesting to think, you know, there's the focal object, the person. Yeah. There's my mind, yeah, apprehending that person as a self-sufficient, substantially existent thing. That's what my mind is holding. There's a person there, but what my mind is apprehending is not that person, but a self-sufficient, substantially existent person. Yeah. And what's appearing to my mind is the conceptual appearance of self-sufficient, substantially existent person. So then, can you get a feeling why that's called an erroneous consciousness? You know, because your observed object is just the person, but what we're apprehending is something, you know, completely made up.
So yeah. Isn't apprehension, would it be fair to say that the apprehension is simply some kind of an overlay that you're putting on the object?
When the consciousness is mistaken with respect to its apprehended object, then it's holding on to an overlay that we've, or something erroneous about it. Okay.
So a focal object would always have to be inexistent.
Yeah, any of these objects has to be inexistent, because remember, existent is synonymous with.
The SSSE is inexistent.
Right, and that's why I was asking you: is it a real object? It's called the apprehended object, but we don't really say it's the, I mean, we're just saying that for the sake here, but it's not a real apprehended object. Why? Because it doesn't exist.
But a focal object always would have to be in existence.
Yeah, any of the objects to actually be have to, because object is synonymous with existent. So that's why we say that a cognition is mistaken with respect to a certain object when it apprehends a non-existent. Okay? Existent, yeah. Right, okay. So, let's say the visual consciousness that apprehends two moons. What's the appearing object? Yeah, the appearance of two moons. It has to be something that exists. Two moons don't exist. So it's the appearance of two moons. That's the appearing object. What's the apprehended object?
One moon.
What is that mind apprehending?
Two moons.
Is that mind erroneous or correct with respect to its apprehended object?
Erroneous.
Okay. What's the focal object?
One moon.
One moon. Okay.
Erroneous in respect to its focal object. Erroneous.
Something's always erroneous with respect to its apprehended object. Because it's apprehending something that doesn't exist, so it's erroneous. If you just think about that, you know, the apprehended object is the main thing that the object is holding on to and, you know, perceiving. And so if it's perceiving it incorrectly, then it's going to be wrong with respect, you know, to that. Because it's apprehending a non-existent, which isn't a real apprehended object. Okay. Okay, what about seeing the white snow mountain as blue? What's the appearing object? Appearance of a blue mountain. Okay, what kind of is this conceptual or non-conceptual? Non-conceptual. So the appearing object is the appearance of a blue snow mountain. What's the apprehended object?
Blue snow mountain.
Is that consciousness erroneous or correct?
Erroneous.
With respect to its apprehended object. What is the focal object?
The mountain.
Yeah, the snow mountain. Okay. When you're angry, okay. Yeah, think of something, you know. You're angry, and you're going, oh, that person, you know, they said this and this and this to me. Is that a conceptual or non-conceptual consciousness?
Conceptual.
Okay. So you're mad at, you know, Charlie, because Charlie, you know, didn't wash his dish after lunch, okay? And then when you asked him to wash his dish, he said, who do you think you are telling me what to do? Yeah? Yeah, he was somebody wearing blue. So he said, who do you think you are telling me what to do? Now the people wearing blue are, you know, getting really angry here. Okay. So, you're mad at Charlie, because Charlie said that. Okay, of course, Charlie's mad at you, too. But let's take, you're mad at Charlie. What is your appearing object?
The
conceptual appearance of this stupid, ignorant Charlie. Okay. Yeah. What is your apprehended object?
Jerk.
Yeah. So when you're angry, your apprehended object is jerk Charlie. Okay. Is that a correct consciousness?
Yes.
Oh, you weren't sure about that one. When you're angry, is that a correct consciousness?
No.
It feels like it, but it's not. Okay, what's your focal object?
Charlie.
Okay, so you're wrong with respect to that apprehended object. Now, of course, Charlie, who's wearing blue, who's looking at you, is mad at you because you're telling him what to do. So what's his appearing object?
It's a mean jerk.
Yeah, the conceptual appearance of you jerk. Okay. And then what's the apprehended object? Yeah, you as a jerk. And what's the focal object? You. Okay. Is that a correct consciousness? Or it's erroneous consciousness. So here you have two people in the kitchen, you know, going after each other, both having erroneous consciousnesses. Yeah? And both not thinking, I have an erroneous consciousness. Both thinking, I have a reliable cognizer.
Exactly.
Neither one of them are thinking that what they're apprehended does not exist. Yeah. But both apprehend, thinking, what I apprehend does exist. I'm sure. And see, all my friends agree that Charlie is a jerk. And then Charlie's friends all agree that you're a jerk. Exactly.
Yeah.
We have entire nations that are sitting there killing each other because of erroneous cognizers.
Wow.
Yeah. So do you see why this is important to learn how it relates to life? Yeah. To really sit there and as we go through the day, to be able to discern, when do I have an erroneous cognizer and when do I have a correct a reliable cognizer? Yeah? Okay. So, when you're walking down the road, there's a scarecrow, but you see a person. What's the appearing object? There is a scarecrow, but you think it's a person. What's the appearing object?
Scarecrow.
It's a scarecrow that you think is a person. What is the appearing object?
The scarecrow.
The scarecrow.
I got this mixed up last week.
Yeah. And the two moons don't.
So the person doesn't
exist. Oh, yeah, okay. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so your appearance is a person.
Yes.
Okay.
The engaged object is the scarecrow.
Okay. Now the apprehended object is. Yeah, is
it? The apprehended object is the same as the engaged object.
No, the yeah, which is. A scarecrow? No, which is a person. Now I'm getting confused. But what you're at, okay, it's a person.
Right.
What you're apprehending is a scarecrow.
Right.
So your apprehended object and engaged object are a scarecrow. No,
okay.
No, wait. Oh, I just changed the example. Okay. Okay, so it's a scarecrow. Okay, it's a scarecrow. And you think it's a person. So your apprehended object is a person. Okay. The appearing object is the appearance of a person. Or you could say a scarecrow, actually, because a scarecrow is what's appearing. Or you could say the appearance of a person.
This is a visual consciousness.
But the scarecrow is what's being beheld. That's the focal object.
Yeah, the focal object is the scarecrow. Right.
Apprehended object looks like a person.
Yeah. Okay, so the appearing object is the appearance of the person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
But the scarecrow is
inexistent
while the two moons are not. Does that make a difference?
That's why I'm thinking that you might be able to say the appearing object is actually the scarecrow.
It says object that actually appears to a particular cognizer, not necessarily the object the cognizer is apprehending. So if it's a visual consciousness that is having a direct perception of that object, it's the scarecrow, it's apprehending scarecrow. It as a person.
Yeah.
Yes?
Right.
Yes.
The appearing is the scarecrow that the apprehending
is the
person.
The appearing is the scarecrow, the person.
No, the appearing is the scarecrow that's appearing as a person.
But the apprehended
is a person.
Yeah. Because if ever nobody tells me anything and I always wish they with the person in my mind, not a scarecrow.
Right, but it is actually a scarecrow.
Yes.
So the appearing from what I
is a scarecrow appearing as a person.
So what if it's a scarecrow appearing as a scarecrow? The appearing object would be a scarecrow.
Yeah. And what would your apprehended object be?
A scarecrow.
Well,
the appearance of a scarecrow.
Yeah, it would just be a scarecrow. No, the apprehended object would be the scarecrow.
The scarecrow.
Like when you you're perceiving blue, your apprehended object, your appearing object is blue.
And your apprehended object is also
blue. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's tricky. It's tricky.
Yeah, it is. And also sometimes they word it in different ways, because they often wouldn't go through this thing and say, what's the appearing object? They would just say the sentence of, the scarecrow appears as a person. They wouldn't say the appearing object is this and this. Mm-hmm. Probably because it runs into this kind of difficulty. Mm-hmm. So when you read the books, they'll just say, oh, it's a scarecrow appearing as a person. But what you're apprehending is person, and that's erroneous.
Right.
Yeah. So that's how they often word it. Okay? Oh, there was another interesting one. What was it? Where did it go? It was about an echo.
Oh.
So let's try an echo. Okay, so there's an echo. What's your appearing object?
Sounds.
The echo. What's your apprehended object?
Echo.
Oh, good, cool question.
What's your apprehended object?
Sound.
An echo, yeah.
No, it's you think it's a real sound, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well,
yeah, your apprehended object is an actual articulate, sound. Yeah, but the echo is mistaken, because it's when you hear an echo, it sounds like there's a real sound coming there, but there's not. You're apprehending it as the actual sound coming from there.
Hmm? Isn't it an actual sound anyway?
Yeah. Or even if you are, with your ear consciousness, it seems like there's an echo. It's your mental consciousness that is telling you it's not a real person over there calling out, hey, you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But just your ear is hearing, oh, you know, there's somebody out over there saying, hey, you. When,
right. Like
when there's somebody back there. Yeah.
So what's the appearing object or what's the apprehended object?
Okay, so the appearing object is the echo. Okay. And the apprehended object is an articulate sound
coming
from the other place.
Could be the appearance of the sound.
Yeah, you could probably also say the appearing object is the appearance of a sound coming from there. Or you could say an echo appearing as a real sound.
Mm-hmm.
So probably any of those ways of saying it. That's why I say they often don't say the appearing object is da 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 da. They'll say, oh, it's an echo appearing as a real sound. Okay? So it's an interesting thing to think about. But especially, you know, like when you have some kind of emotion, when you're, you know, like there's something you really want. Okay, think of something you really want. Yeah, what do you want? What's your latest object you're dissatisfied with? A what?
Awakening.
No. Your pillow. Okay. So there's Jack craving his pillow. Yeah. so much attachment to his pillow, he can't wait to put his head in that pillow. Okay, so it's a mind of attachment. What's the appearing object? First of all, is it conceptual or non-conceptual?
Conceptual.
Conceptual. What's the appearing object?
Conceptual appearance of a pillow.
Just a conceptual appearance of a pillow?
The bed.
This is a mind of attachment.
Beautiful.
Okay. So the conceptual appearance of this incredibly, you know, soft pillow that's going to help you sleep really well so that you awaken very refreshed. Okay? For the benefit of all sentient beings. So that's remember? Yeah. So that's the appearing object to this mind of attachment. Okay. What's the engaged or apprehended object?
The whole story, the visual thing.
That pillow that is going to make me everlastingly happy.
Right.
That's what your mind is apprehending. Is that consciousness erroneous or accurate with respect to its apprehended object?
Erroneous.
And what's the focal object?
Pillow.
Sorry. Yeah.
Can you, again, I know everybody understands what conceptual and non-conceptual.
Yeah. Conceptual is when one of the, your sense, like your five senses, eye, ear, you know, nose, tongue, body, those are always non-conceptual cognizers. They perceive the object direct, the raw sense data. We can also have a mental non-conceptual mind, like, for example, if you're apprehending the impermanence of the sweater or something like that, okay? So that's a yogic direct perceiver, that's a direct perception. Conceptual minds are ones where you're thinking about something, where you're remembering something, where you're planning something, okay?
Put that in reverse. But if you do the example of seeing the green, it's helpful. You see that green thing there, and that's direct perception. When you close your eyes and think about it, it's not direct perception. Now you have
but seeing the groom is non-conceptual.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you're looking.
I said it's conceptual.
Huh.
But that's the word. The word is cognition that covers all of them. You're always cognizant. The conception is a thought.
Yeah, conception is thought. Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, good.
Are you in the book Insight into Emptiness? It's mentioned of how the mind is always mistaken in relation to the appearing object.
Yeah.
Now, talk about
okay. Now, when see right now we're doing this according to Sautantrika. Okay. So according to Sautantrika, the appearance of true existence is not a mistaken appearance. According to Prasangika, the appearance of true existence is a mistaken appearance. So according to Prasangika, you know, when we see anything, it's appearing truly existent. So all of our cognizers, you know, our everyday cognizers are mistaken with respect to the appearing object because they're appearing truly existent. We aren't always grasping them as being truly existent, but they're appearing that way. But according to the Sautantrika school, which is this one here, they have a very different, you know, you learn it according to Sautantrika, and then when you hear it according to Prasangika, you go, huh, why didn't they teach me that way at the beginning?
Yeah.
Okay? Because also in Sautantrika, permanent things are always the object of conception. Whereas in Prasangika, permanent things can be the object of direct perception. Like, because well, emptiness is
right.
permanent,
right.
and you can have a direct perception of emptiness. Okay, so the schools have different ways of defining all these things. Okay?
Makes your mind nimble.
Yes, makes your mind very nimble. And you learn to, okay, this makes sense for somebody who believes this. This way of looking at things makes sense. For somebody else who believes that, that way, you know, that description makes sense. Then, well, what do I believe? Okay.
That's the sound of a juvenile great horned owl.
What, the, that...
It's not a screech owl.
It's not a screech owl.
I went online last night because I wanted to make sure, and it's... They have a little sound bite, either a female or a juvenile great horn.
Great, how big are the great horned owls?
The great horns are the biggest of the biggest.
Yeah.
We
really?
Have a pair that have lived here for a few years. This might be their
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I remember years ago seeing one of them. And this one, last night, was like hanging out right around my cabin.
That's a great horned.
That's a great horned owl.
And they said either female or juvenile.
Wow.
That's, we did have a pair this spring. One was at Gotami, and there was one up on Bodhisattva Loop. They were hooting at each other. So this might be their...
So the why they make different sounds?
Well, you know, my thinking is that the turkey babies make a different sound when they grow up. They make the
sound.
For juveniles, this is their
It's like baby talk.
This is baby
talk. Baby talk. Okay.
Anyway, that's what that is.
Oh.
Yes, and what was the appearance?
Okay, this is a very good one. Okay, so last night, you know, when I was hearing, when we were hearing that sound, we said, oh, we're hearing a screech owl. Okay? So was that saying we're hearing a screech owl, is that conceptual or non-conceptual?
Conceptual.
Conceptual. What was the appearing object?
Screech owl.
So
the conception.
Our conception.
Appearance. Well, so we had the sound, but we had the idea that it was a screech owl. Right? Two separate things.
So the sound is there.
The sound.
Yeah. So let's do, what's the apprehended object? Screech owl.
Screech owl.
Screech owl. So that consciousness is mistaken.
Yeah.
So then go, what's the appearing object? Or a conceptual appearance of a gray-horned owl as a screech owl. You know? Yeah.
Misidentified it.
Yeah, and what's the focal object?
Owl.
Greyhound, gray-horned. Gray-horned?
Great-horned.
Do they have gray horns?
They have
great. Great horns.
They're big
enough
to ears.
Oh. So they're actual horns. They're not the ears of an owl.
But they look like, you know, in all.
So when we say the horns of an owl, that's like the horns of a rabbit. They don't exist.
Right.
Ah. So it's actually the.
It's not their ears. It's just feathers.
It's not horns or ears.
But it's not horns.
No, it's over their ears.
No ears.
There's just feathers. Okay, but there's no horns.
No.
It looks like horns.
It looks like horns. So
appearance of horns.
So a great. So calling it a great. Yeah. If we say the horns of an owl. Okay. If you're apprehending the horns of an owl, is that a reliable cognizer?
No.
It's an erroneous cognizer, isn't it?
Like the scarecrow and the person, it's the appearance of this.
Yeah, it's the appearance of horns. Yeah.
I'll find out more.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's a great horned owl.
But it has no horns that suit
function. But it's called a horned owl.
For a good reason.
Yeah.
It's
a label. But you can see.
So it's a horn, it's the label.
No,
there's a function that horns.
Right, but they say rhinoceroses have horns, but they don't. Those are just nails.
Yeah.
Right? It's like a nail product, you know? So the whole idea of a horn is in the first place.
We have many things named in a way that doesn't actually describe them.
Yeah.
Like
it describes the appearance.
Yeah. For example, you know, in the summer, something grows, and you go out there and you say, oh, I planted squash. Did you plant squash?
No.
You planted seeds. But we say, I planted squash, don't we? Yeah, so lots of times we're saying things that everybody understands, like a great horned owl, but we're not really naming it correctly.
That's
right. Yeah. Well, in the case of the, they always talk about giving the name of a result to the cause, like when you say, I planted squash, you're giving the name of the result to the cause. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So the great horned owl giving the name of an appearance to something that doesn't have that.
Yeah,
sure. Okay. So let's offer the mandala. Is the mandala existent or non-existent? Can you create merit by offering a non-existent?
Yes. Yes.
Why?
Because of your mind.
Because
of
your motivation.
Because what?
Because of your motivation. Because you believe it.
No, because of the generosity. No, it's the same
generosity. Because it results in happiness.
Yeah. Okay. You're offering the Buddha
a non-existent
object. What is it that makes that virtuous?
The intention.
Part of it is your intention, but part of it is, what are you visualizing?
The universe.
You're thinking of the entire universe. What are you offering?
Everything.
So it doesn't matter whether there's, you know, a central mountain and everything else. What matters is your computer's in it, your iPad's in it, your, you know, Buddha boy's in it. Everything's in it, and you're offering all of that.
And the power of the object that you're offering to.
Yeah, the power of the object, the power of your motivation.
So what's the appearing object?
What's the appearing object? When you're visualizing, well, first, is it conceptual or non-conceptual?
Conceptual.
Okay, so what's the appearing object?
Everything.
If it's a conceptual cognizer. As soon as you talk about the appearing object of a conceptual cognizer, what do you have to say first?
The conceptual.
Conceptual appearance of the entire universe according to the ancient Indian cosmology. That's your...
That's why we're saying we're planting squash.
Yeah. And then what's your apprehended object? The chocolate you're going to eat as soon as you get done with this prayer that you're not paying any attention to.
Yeah,
that's right. Uh-oh. No. What's your apprehended object? No, that's the appearing object. It's the conceptual appearance of the entire universe.
It's the entire universe is the
apprehended object is whatever it is that you're imagining that you're offering.
Whatever it is you're imagining offering. Okay.
And the focal object.
The focal object should be the entire universe. Okay. Yeah?
When we offer the universe, like, is it important to see all the stars and as much as we can see?
Well, they say when you're doing the mandala offering to try and make your visualization as clear as possible. I think that's because there's symbolism to each of the different things that you're offering. Yeah. But what I think, for me, what makes the mandala offering very powerful is when I think of specific things or people or ideas or whatever that I'm attached to. You know, Oh, or when I think of my body, when I,
The one that you taught us about.
About, yeah, the inner offering, when you transform your body into the mandala. Yeah, that's quite powerful. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase.
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzing Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Ashrabasti Abbey in the West Florida.